Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is Need, Speed, and Greed with Vijay Vethiswaran in conversation with Michael Meyer of Essential Design. Michael is someone that I really appreciate, who I thought would be a nice conversation with Vijay. Michael has a very interesting background, started out as a naval nuclear engineer. He really is a rocket scientist. Went from there to the Harvard MBA program, and from there was recruited to IDEO, went from IDEO to Frog, and then became the CEO of Adaptive Path, and has now opening the Essential Design office here in San Francisco. Vijay Vethiswaran is a wonderful man. I think followed his writings, and I'm very happy to have him here today. He is senior correspondent for The Economist magazine, has been with The Economist for over 20 years, has lived and reported from all over the world. It's a wonderful new book, so I'm looking forward to our program today, and I'm going to turn it over to Michael and Vijay.
Great. Thank you. Having heard about this podium, my Napoleon complex takes over, and I have to give my opening comments from here. Thank you. It's a tremendous honor to be here. It really is. And thank you so much for coming out in full force for your being willing to contribute your time, but also, I hope, your tough questions, because what I want to really get going is a conversation. And that's part of why I wrote this book, is to really engage in a conversation about our future. We live in a time of extraordinary challenges, of wicked global problems, of a middle-class squeeze here at home, of an educational system and career tracks that are increasingly disconnected from the needs of the 21st century ideas economy. And so I thought what I would do in just giving you a bit of a teaser of what's in the book before we sit down and have a proper chat on stage and with you all is to give you a couple of the main ideas in the book and maybe offer you three new rules of innovation and debunk a couple of myths. The rules I'll give you: move nimbly, open wisely, fail gracefully. And the myths I hope to debunk along the way will persuade you that losing is winning, that greed can be glorious, and that disruptive dads beat tiger moms. So let's see how far I get with that one. When I start with need in my title, Need, Speed, and Greed, I wanted to make it clear that I'm not one of those rosy-eyed techno-utopians who thinks that technology will solve all problems. Indeed, when I start to talk about innovation, the first thing I say is, innovation is not technology, even though it's often conflated with invention. This is one of the great myths that we find. Many people will get together in a room and say, oh, yes, we're all in favor of innovation, because we're all in favor of gadgets and gizmos and patents and PhDs and more money for science and technology education. These are all good things. Don't get me wrong. I'm in favor of all of them. But innovation, in my view, in my book, is fresh thinking, which may or may not involve new technology, that creates value, that creates something valuable. If you're a company, it creates value for your customers. If you're a social enterprise, and there's a dynamic explosion of energy and entrepreneurship in the social sector, which I hope we'll talk some more about, which I write about in the book, you're creating value for your stakeholders. And if you're the new breed of government bureaucrat that's trying to make government more open, transparent, responsive, and innovative, you create value for citizens. But I think we really need to tear apart this conflation, especially seen amongst our technology friends in Silicon Valley, that technology is innovation only if it creates value in a meaningful way. And equally, I'm equally tough on my friends in finance on Wall Street, where I say just because you've come up with another clever financial instrument, don't call it innovation. And that's part of where we went wrong with the financial crisis, is a bit too bedazzled by claims of innovation that of little, if social value. Indeed, a sector that sucked in a huge amount of human talent and the country's productive potential and destroyed value, and we gave it a very light regulatory touch, an improper level of scrutiny because of claims of innovation. So I want to hold us all to a higher standard about what I mean by innovation. And so that's just as a beginning. And also to say the challenges are real, and I take them extremely seriously, having worked for, as I say, two decades in The Economist with frontline reporting in the 1990s, covering development issues, the issues of poverty. I opened our bureau in Mexico City in the 90s and covered the challenges on the ground of dealing with free trade in developing countries and the disruption that it poses, but also the opportunities something like NAFTA might pose for emerging economies. My next job was energy and environment, where for a decade I covered climate change, Enron and the California power crisis, seeing the limits of markets, but also the potential of transforming one of the slowest moving and most dinosauric of industries, but that one that contains the seeds of rejuvenation in dealing with the problem of climate change in a more dynamic way. More recently, I was their pharmaceuticals correspondent and covered not only the politics of healthcare in Washington, but also the emerging pandemics threat. And again, that persuaded me that we live in an age of wicked global problems. This is a time when it is more dangerous to be alive from the perspective of potential pandemics than it was 30 or 40 years ago because of our hyperconnectedness. You know, the seamy underbelly of the globalization and Googleization that has brought such a wave of prosperity in the last two, three decades to many people, it means we are much more connected and vulnerable as well. We haven't even begun to deal with these difficult challenges. We've been focused on other challenges, important ones, but the war on terror post 9/11, the financial crisis post Enron, post Lehman. But these are not the most difficult challenges we face. They're important ones. Don't get me wrong. We must deal with them. But political terrorism has been with us for over 1,000 years. It's not new. And the financial crises, gosh, think about the South Sea bubbles, the tulip manias. Crisis and capitalism go hand in hand. These are not novel problems. The difficult problems have to do with the rise of China, India, a billion more people coming out of poverty, but joining the quest for resources, sort of the food, energy, water nexus, as it's been called. That's a challenge of unprecedented size and scope. Climate change, pandemics, dealing with the middle class squeeze here at home. It's right to ask, what is our taxation policy in Washington, and why do 1% make off with lots of the gains? But I say, don't stop that question. Ask why the bottom 1% and the bottom billion have actually done really well in the last 10 to 20 years. That's a story you don't hear enough about. But what's happening in terms of global innovation has actually helped the poorest people on Earth in extraordinary ways, in part because of the arrival of mobile telephony and other leapfrogging technologies, micro-franchise and micro-enterprise and micro-credit models, mobile banking. If you're in Kenya, a company called M-Pesa lets you send money via mobile phone. Whereas, you know, my old money center bank on Wall Street that got a bailout and is too big to fail doesn't let me do that. It makes you wonder, what's going on here, right? Yeah. I mean, it's actually a wonderful time to be alive in many ways. And so the elites of Mumbai are closer to the elites of Manhattan. The bottom billion are actually now not only receiving benefits from this global economy and innovation revolution, they're contributing as innovators by connecting to global markets. There are companies like SamaSource, which is based right here out of San Francisco, that connect business opportunities for outsourcing to poor people using mobile phones, contributing in a small way for micropayments to the global economy, or big ways with big ideas by starting micro multinationals from day one. You don't have to think small. You can think big, even if you're at the bottom of the pyramid. But my question is, what about Kansas? What about the heartland of America? What about the Rust Belt? What about traditional industries, not just in America, but across the developed world? What you find, and I've looked very hard, because this is one of the things that has motivated me to write this book, is we live at a time of prosperity and plenty in many ways. And as I say, it's not just the 1% that are benefiting at the top. People at the bottom are benefiting too, or in developing countries. But increasingly, many people who've worked hard their whole lives, blue-collar workers and white-collar workers with seemingly good educations at good companies, are feeling increasingly left behind. They're not feeling the benefits of this prosperity that's happening, and that's part of why we see anger on both the left and the right in our political system. And there's a sense that something big is happening, and somebody else is getting the benefits, if you know what I mean. And in part because the tools of innovation and the rules of innovation are changing incredibly fast. That's the speed part of my need, speed and greed. And because the very tools and rules of innovation are changing, which has been referred to as meta-innovation, that is, the very rules about how we innovate are themselves being innovated at a rapid pace. Unless we can have access to them, unless we change how we learn, and this is one of my lessons for all of us, is we need to keep relearning how to learn, because we live in an ideas economy. And the career track, the professional training, even the fancy degrees, never mind the worker trainings and the educations we all got, and I'm a proud result of public education in America, It can no longer keep up. It's not enough. We have to keep relearning how to learn. Part of why I wrote the book was to try to point the way forward to get that conversation going. So I say all this to say I'm not an optimist. I'm an impatient realist. Because the problems are real, but equally so too is the opportunity. There's an innovation revolution happening from the bottom up, in part because of exponentially growing technologies. We know about software, you know about the internet, big data will transform industry after industry, but genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, omics we haven't even named yet, synthetic biology. I mean, who would have thought 5 years ago that synthetic biology could prove one of the important solutions to the clean energy challenge? It was a field that didn't even exist 5 years ago. But here we are. That's one of the real prospects. Entirely new industries are being created, and with them will come jobs that we can't even imagine today. That's part of the message that I have, is we have to remember the dynamism. As long as we remain open to ideas, to people, to the flow of goods and services, and don't fall into a zero-sum mentality, that's the real challenge. China up doesn't have to mean America down, if we do the right things. If we see innovation as a rising tide that can lift many boats, but not all boats, not the ones that have holes in the vessels, right? And part of my message is we have work to do in America to shore up our vessel, to look at things, for example, like higher education. It's a travesty to cut to the bone on the University of California educational system. This is one of the crown jewels of our American innovation ecosystem, in my view. And similarly, I was on Capitol Hill arguing on behalf of a dozen leading scientific societies just a couple of weeks ago in front of a skeptical audience in both the House and the Senate that we need to continue to invest in federal R&D to support with government taxpayer dollars. And bear in mind, I'm a free market guy from The Economist, right? I believe in markets. I believe the solutions will come from the bottom up. But there is a vital role, but a carefully circumscribed role, for the government as an enabler of innovation. Not in picking the future Solyndras or nuclear energy winners. That's the wrong role, right? You don't pick technology winners. Government has a lousy track record. But in fundamental research, all of the economics literature shows this is an area that has lots of spillovers to society and that the market won't do it on itself. And to cut in that area at a moment when times are tough, I understand. We need to cut in defense, in entitlement spending. We need to do difficult things. But to cut in areas like education, key areas of smart infrastructure or R&D, what that does is lower our future growth capacity, reduces the pipeline for future innovation. That's absolutely the wrong way to go. Smart companies know that you invest in a downturn. So should smart countries. And so I make that case because I think it's important for us to invest at this time. All this is to say there is an innovation revolution that's gathering pace, but we need to do better to connect incentives. And here I come to the greed part of my argument. I believe in not burying capitalism, as some people would want you to do, but in saving it, because I think fundamentally the solutions to these wicked problems are not going to come from moonshots. Like some people say, climate change will be solved only by a moonshot. I think I hear a rocket going by as we speak, actually, on the way to the moon. And here's why. And remember, I started by saying I want the government to have a role, but sending a man to the moon once, cost be damned. To beat the Soviets, I mean, we wrote the blank check because of national security. Let's be honest. For clean energy, it requires a fundamentally different approach. Making sure 7 billion people on Earth have clean energy in a way that's affordable, sustainable, convenient, that requires a bottom-up approach. That requires experimentation, failure, trying again. Is government good at any of those things? Yeah, I don't think so. One failure with Solyndra, and imagine how risk-averse Washington is now, right? And so we need bottom-up models, whether they're private sector entrepreneurs or social sector entrepreneurs, of whom there are many working on hybrid business models and new ways of harnessing incentives. So I say let's move from greed is good, the kind of Wall Street model of Gordon Gekko capitalism. Let's go to harnessing greed for good. Let's provide greater rewards to innovators who work on socially important problems. We're much more than we do today. So that's my message with need, speed, and greed. I'm happy to delve into it and explain to you some of my rules and riddles and debunking of the myths. But I think we have a incredibly talented provocateur who's going to tease them out of me in better ways than I could. So I'll stop talking and I'll start the conversation.
Vijay, thank you. Thank you for getting us started.
thinking about some of these topics that would be interesting fodder for conversation today. And I think in the spirit of conversation, one thing that I'd like to point out to everyone here in the room with us is that we very much do want to engage you in a conversation. So we'll have some conversation between ourselves and a few points at a few points in our conversation, open it up for questions, comments from the audience. One word of warning, I have been inspired to be ruthless about insisting that people come with questions rather than pontifications. So as we open it up...
The only guest bag allowed is me, I'm afraid.
I'm hot on your heels, actually. So please do be thinking of interesting questions that can fuel our conversation, and we'll open it up several points during our conversation here for questions from the audience. One of the things that you talked about was, what about Kansas? And having grown up in the Midwest, I definitely want to make sure that we get back to Kansas mm-hmm. and not forget it. But before we do that, one of the themes that I noticed in your writings was there are many, many worrying trends these days. And the naysayers, the doomsayers, the people who would like us to take emergency measures and bury our heads in the sand are able to make a lot of ground with those, talking about trends like increasing urbanization and the stress that that's going to place on the infrastructure, the crowding, the social problems that will come from that. A lot of times, or consistently throughout your writing, these themes that look problematic end up turning around to be really sources of hope for us. Thinking particularly about urbanization, we can look at the ill effects of it, but we can also look at the beneficial effects of it. One of the things that you pointed out was that there's actually empirical evidence that people in an urban setting tend to be more creative or more contributory to the mass of creativity than people in a rural setting. That's something that really sits a little bit at odds with, I think, the typical Silicon Valley image of the genius inventor, the guy that's sitting in the laboratory working on a great idea, and through their own brilliance brings a new invention or innovation into the world. I'd like to talk a little bit more about this, the increasing creativity from the urban setting
sure.
versus the individual contributor.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. You know, if we do things wrong, the age of urban man, that is, mankind is this urban species only as of the last 2 years. Through all of our history, of course, we have been a predominantly rural species. China crossed that line just 2 months ago as a country, and we know what the trend line is. Within 20 years, perhaps 70% of humanity will be living in some form of megalopolis or another. And this is an extraordinary inflection point in human history. If we do things in a thoughtless way, this could be a tragedy. It's right to worry about that because, you know, the evidence of slums and favelas shows that it's not always done in a thoughtful way. If we do it like our exurban sprawl model, as some cities in the U.S. have shown, it could be very resource-intensive and damaging. But the opportunity, as a great thinker like Stuart Brand, for example, who makes his home just around the corner in Sausalito, he has argued that as a great heresy to the environmentalists, if we do this right, urbanization could be the great opportunity to save the planet. If we do it properly with intelligent infrastructure, having greater density of humans means energy can be used much more efficiently, as opposed to exurban sprawl where subsidized water leads to enormous McMansions. We can imagine a different way of doing urbanization that can be better for the planet than the current approach. And the point that's been made in the some wonderful studies done by Jeffrey West of the Santa Fe Institute, one of the great institutions of higher thinking in America, he has studied creativity, invention, and innovation. Of course, those are different things. And he has found that urban dwellers are an order of magnitude more innovative, on his definitions, than their country bumpkin cousins. Now, this will offend people who live in the countryside. And, of course, if you make extraordinary efforts to be well-connected to the hotspots of innovation around the world and you have a good wireless or satellite access and you travel frequently from your mountaintop lodge or a country cabin, wherever you happen to enjoy nature, then you can be as productive or more, probably more so, without the nuisances, annoyances of city life. But broadly speaking, the serendipitous interactions that happen in cities, you tend to get a critical mass in lots of ways for the things that matter in the ideas economy. Because, again, increasingly, what creates value are better ideas. Mm-hmm. And once you move from creating value through brawn to creating value through the brain, you get to a world of infinite possibilities, infinite growth. And the old idea that resources are limited, therefore growth is limited, therefore population is a bomb, therefore we're going to run out of things, I think it has been disproved time and time again. But that's not to say there won't be challenges or that it won't be messy, there won't be local crises or local scarcities. But my argument here is that when we begin to tap that well of infinite resource, and that is the last remaining natural resource of infinite quantity, that's human ingenuity, then we really have the chance to solve any of these problems. Cities are going to be the crucibles of innovation. And contrary to what some have claimed, the world is not flat. The world is lumpy and bumpy, and innovation happens in ways that connects those nodes and hotspots. And it's wrong to think about brain drain. You should think about brain circulation, because the hotspots, whether it's here in Northern California or Israel or Taiwan or parts of China, parts of India, Chile, places that are buzzing with ideas, activity, entrepreneurship, value creation, are actually connected to each other and to the rest of the world in very dynamic ways. And those knowledge networks that cities represent the nodes of are actually the lion's share of value in today's world. They're intangibles in the language of economists. But it's not just that at the end of the day, you know, the Commonwealth Club's members, when they leave this room, most of the value of the Commonwealth Club leaves, just as it does at Google or Twitter. It's that it's not just your brain cells, it's the networks you've created in a world of open, connected, user-driven innovation. It's not what resides on your laptops or even in the cloud. It's that intangible, and that's where cities play such an important role.
You know, it's really interesting to think about how you can take from that that sort of mega view to the micro view. One of the things that I've noticed, having worked in a number of creative studios, some great, some not so great, is that the most important part of a studio, and you know, if you ask somebody who doesn't work in a creative studio, if you ask them what is the most important part, some people might say, well, it's the CAD servers, the CAD stations. Some people might say, well, it's the brainstorming room. Some people might say it's the shop where people work with their hands. One of the things that I've noticed and come to believe very strongly is that the most important part of a good creative studio is the kitchen. Because the kitchen is where people meet each other when they're not really thinking about what they should be thinking about, or when they're thinking deeply about what they should be thinking about and they're finding themselves stuck and they need to take a break and they go for the cup of coffee. And they run into somebody who sees them just kind of staring distractedly off into space, who asks, what's up? What's on your mind? And I found for myself personally, and I've seen it happen in others, and it's a wonderful thing to see as it happens, the dawning of a new way of thinking about a problem that you've been running at over and over again, just from those happenstance encounters.
I have absolutely nothing to add because you put it so beautifully. I know enough to recognize genius when I see it. No, you're absolutely right. And looking at problems with that fresh eye in a new way, mm-hmm. I think is really what we need for a lot of the challenges we face. And that's part of what I want to provoke a conversation. Mm-hmm. Let's look at our difficult problems. Let's be sober in our assessment. Mm-hmm. Let's not fall back into nativism and xenophobia. The world is bristling with challenges, but also opportunities. And if we recognize how to learn, not only, you know, if we imagine the kitchen is not just America, but the world, then I think we may get even better ideas by connecting with other parts of the world and seeing that rising tide that can lift many boats.
So as we think about this global kitchen to foster innovation, and we think about some of these tools that we can use to promote the free thinking, the creative thinking. I think there is the danger out there that not all creativity, not all innovation is necessarily a good thing, right? Creativity from a designer is great when they're working on a product. Creativity from an accountant when they're doing your taxes is not necessarily a great thing. So what are some of the things that we need to think about, what are some of the things that we ought to do and demand from our governments in order to, I don't know, should we be bounding these areas of creativity or the areas of exploration? Should we be expressly guiding it? Should we have these government programs, the the Sputniks and the moon launches, and I think I know what your answer is to that. but how do we gently nudge the innovation and the creativity so that it's actually going to benefit us rather than just a few individuals at the benefit or at the expense of the rest of us?
You know, I would say if you look at innovation, is it always a good thing? I'd say no, not necessarily. That's part of why the word greed is in my title. You know, in the 90s, I was our bureau chief in Latin America, and at a time when the drugs trade was just taking off and taking over a wonderful country, Mexico, and corrupting its democracy. And I saw, because I covered that story, how drug cartels can be incredibly inventive in the use of technology, new business models, and finding ways to serve their customers better. But I think all of us would agree we don't want to encourage this kind of malicious globalization.
I remember the first reports of drug runners using submarines to bring their loads.
Absolutely.
Into the
United States. And this is going back to the 90s. The Colombian cartels did that. But my point is the tools and rules are available to everyone to use. Let's make sure the good guys use them more effectively and to good ends. And that's part of why I say, as a society, if we come together and we find ways to reward innovators that work on socially important problems, mm-hmm. on difficult challenges that often suffer from market failure, mm-hmm. from policy failure, mm-hmm. what are sometimes known as tragedies of the commons. Mm-hmm. And, again, climate change is a good example mm-hmm. Of one where there's a problem because the inputs and outputs are disconnected by time. Actions today may have consequences in the future. Mm-hmm. They may have consequences on people who are somewhere else mm-hmm. In the world rather than here. But another example that doesn't get the attention has to do with superbugs and something that affects us right now in the here and now. Bacterial superbugs, that is drug-resistant bacteria, are on the rise, and you'll know this from some of the newspapers. TB, for example, the extreme forms of TB that are drug-resistant are very much on the rise, resistant bugs in hospitals. And this is a related problem to the pandemics problem I mentioned before, one that demands extraordinary vigilance. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Pharmaceutical companies don't have adequate incentive to work on this problem. Mm-hmm. And why? One, it's a really hard problem. And again, because I used to be healthcare correspondent, I've talked with the heads of R&D at most of the big pharma companies, as well as the small biotechs and the NGOs in this space and the government guys. Our cupboard is dry. I'm sorry to say that. I don't want to be a gloommonger, but on this, and I write about this in some depth in the book, a lot of the low-hanging fruit has been picked mm-hmm. in terms of antibiotics, and R&D isn't paying off in this area. Mm-hmm. Genomics is a complete failure as far as it comes to this area. And there was an article published in the journal Nature by the head of one of the leading pharma companies where they said, we've tried all the tools of genomics and we give up. We're going back to the hunt and peck method of using berries and leaves and hopefully, maybe we'll find something that will prove a good antibiotic. We are really struggling and companies are actually paring back their budgets. You might say, mm-hmm. there could be a global tragedy waiting. Why are we not doubling investment or coming up with more? Mm-hmm. When you actually look at how antibiotics are rewarded in the marketplace, a good antibiotic is effective. Maybe you get paid for using it once for 2 weeks. Compare that to making the next Lipitor or, heaven forbid, yet another Viagra, where the companies make huge amounts of money on an ongoing basis. Mm-hmm. Even healthcare systems like the UK's NHS and other government systems reward cancer drugs and other kinds of drugs on a morbidity and mortality basis, that is, economic cost-benefit analysis. Antibiotics don't get rewarded properly. We under-reward them. So when I say when we actually reward socially useful innovation, mm-hmm. let's think about our policies. This is a role for government. When we think about how we reward and encourage innovation in this space, I can make the argument on climate change by saying mm-hmm. rather than subsidize renewable energy companies or, heaven forbid, oil companies, which Congress tried to do something about this week but failed, let's eliminate all subsidies for everyone, but instead impose externalities policies. And I'm not running for office, you can tell, because I'm going to say we need carbon taxes. We need to have measures like carbon taxes or comparable equivalent trading systems, because until energy, dirty energy, pays its fair share mm-hmm. in the marketplace, clean energy has no chance. You can never subsidize an individual clean energy technology that happens to be cuddly and enamored of by the green community, as long as the incumbents enjoy a free ride. And so that's why I say we need to really harness that policy to change incentives. Mm-hmm. Then the solutions will emerge from the bottom up.
So there are really, sort of two fundamental levers that we're talking about here. One is capturing externalities and making the people who are benefiting from these externalities actually bear the full brunt of the costs. The other is fostering or properly rewarding innovation, new products that benefit society in a way that is larger than their surface economic value would seem to indicate. So things like carbon taxes, allowing carbon credits and carbon trading, it's a fairly well-discussed, at least a fairly straightforward method of dealing with some of these dirty energy sources. How would that play out in some of the other industries that rely on externalities? Electronics manufacturing is a very dirty process for some types of electronics, in fact, most types of electronics. some countries, Germany has the Green Punkt system, where you're trying to capture the cost of recycling in the cost of the device itself. Have you seen other examples? Because I'm frankly racking my brain to find other examples of capturing these externalities, and I can't think of any good ones.
Well, I mean, the carbon case is well written up, as you know. Mm-hmm. But, for example, in Denmark, nuclear energy is acknowledged for being low carbon or carbon free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's allowed to participate and benefit from any advantages given to carbon free energy. But they recognize, for example, that uranium waste also has an externality, a huge one. And so they impose externalities, policies, and taxes on there. So there's a 30-year tradition in Europe of thinking mm-hmm. about so-called green taxation, where they use across a range of chemical and other kinds of emissions that impose burdens on society. Mm-hmm. And let's remember, we pay for these things, right? When the carcinogenic dimensions of fossil fuel use kill our children or affect our lungs, we pay through public health. We pay at the hospitals instead of paying at the pump. When the geopolitics of oil introduces security costs, we pay through the Pentagon budget. We pay as taxpayers. But because the cost is not visible at the pump, we think that, gasoline is so expensive. It's a lot more expensive than $5 a gallon if it were to be properly costed. Mm-hmm. But because we don't pay the true price at the mm-hmm. pump, we use a lot more of it than we would otherwise, more inefficiently than we should, mm-hmm. and we also greatly disadvantage any potential alternative. So I think it's really about honesty. I think the way to sell this politically to Americans is not to say I'm going to raise taxes on you. It's to say we Americans believe in honesty and fair pricing. Let's be honest and transparent. Mm-hmm. And this is the true cost of the various alternatives. What do you think? And I think we should have politicians of courage who would make that case.
And we're getting some violent agreement
Excellent.
From the audience over
Excellent.
Here. I mean, I think that that's... You go back to what we all learn as children, honesty is the best policy. Yes. Yes. I mean, I firmly believe that. And actually, if we think about the longer-term implications of being honest about the true costs of whatever it is that we're consuming, I think that it's actually fairly easy to make the argument that this is a cost-neutral proposition for the average person. If we, over the long term, are able to make this transition to paying the true costs at the point of consumption, rather than trying to clean up the externalities after the fact through our taxes, through ongoing wars, through pollution, through healthcare costs.
Absolutely. And we don't have to talk about energy the whole time we're together, but since we're on it, I'll make two small observations based on work in this area. Imposing, say, some sort of gasoline tax as part of a comprehensive carbon tax doesn't have to make Americans poorer mm-hmm. because the way to do it, I've always argued, is to make it revenue neutral. Mm-hmm. That is, every penny that comes in from any kind of carbon taxation would be returned to every household in America as a refund check. Now, you might say, gosh, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you take money in and give it back out? That accomplishes two things. Mm-hmm. First of all, it persuades a very skeptical public that this is not a scheme for big government. Right? The money's not going to Washington into an endless pit to be doled out to favored renewable energy projects, et cetera. It's going to come right back to every American household. But the second thing that it does, now, does everyone get the same amount? Well, let's see. If you are like the beloved former Governor Schwarzenegger and have 7 Hummers and you drive very inefficient vehicles, you're going to spend a lot more on your carbon tax than you're going to get back in the refund check. On the other hand, if you're very virtuous and you take the subway to work and maybe have a light touch with your vehicles, then you're going to actually make out a winner. What that does is it provides incentives to live your life more efficiently. Those that do so will reap a reward, but the society as a whole is not made any poorer, and government is not made any bigger. I've argued for a long time on the pages of The Economist for a revenue-neutral approach to carbon tax. So that's one way this doesn't make us any poorer. And secondly, I actually asked a former chairman of Shell, one of the world's big private sector oil companies, and put him on the spot on this topic. I said, look, if proper carbon taxes were introduced in this way, do you think that we would ultimately end up in a world of higher cost energy? That's a classic argument that's offered by oil companies mm-hmm. to say, oh, Americans will never put up with expensive energy. Mm-hmm. We have to stick with oil or fill in the blank coal because, you know, Americans need cheap energy to power American greatness. And he thought about it, and he said, you know what? During the transition, there may be higher costs, but I really believe that once we move to a world where carbon is properly accounted for, and carbon is a shorthand for externalities generally, energy need not be any more expensive than it is today. That's the former chairman of Shell Oil Company, and I've quoted him in my last book. And so I think that really this is about the cost of transition, how to get from here to there. And as long as you make sure those any taxes are shared back with every American household, and we know how to do refund checks in America, right? I think we learned that in the last 10 years. I think then you can bring many more people on board with this idea.
So we've had the opportunity to dominate the conversation for far too long here. Let's open it up for a question or two from the audience. Who's the first hand? The gentleman in the please come on up. There's a mirror and a brush along the way, if you'd like.
Not that formal of a question. So first of all, thank you for the contribution to your book. I apologize in advance if what I'm about to ask was not covered in it, because I have regret not having finished it in advance of this meeting. So I have two questions that are both related, and they're not addressed explicitly in what I saw in the book. The first is a little lower level than the high level policy discussion we're having now, which is, do you see an increase or decrease in tribalism as a result of our cooperation between the elites of Manhattan and Mumbai, for example?
Define what you mean by tribalism.
As an anecdote about my personal experiences, I've seen this really explicit expression of prejudice by Chinese business people, where they have kind of both simultaneously a nationalistic view of their endeavors and a respect and almost a need for some Western products or Western involvement. It's just only usual. It's only been unusual for me in how explicitly expressed it is, verbally and in actions. And then, so the second related question is for an individual: how would you see an individual interacting with some of the policy prescriptions we have? And this is, I guess, I'll give another anecdote to this: is again from my experience with the Chinese, is that they have seen morph over the last few years from some biases towards returning Chinese to now being biased against returning Chinese, saying their networks and knowledge of what's going on in the ground is perhaps cold or outdated for what's actually going on. So this tumult of globalization and Googleization, as you say, has this meta innovation, again, your word, meta-innovation and impact even for knowledge workers at a very high level in a particular constrained environment, China.
Thank you for your questions. Let me answer the best I can. I'm not an expert on the tribalism topic, but I can give you my anecdotal impression since I do travel the world for my job and I've lived in a number of societies. I think, if I may use a proxy for tribalism, xenophobia, let's say, you do see evidence of that, you know, here in the U.S., there's an anti-immigrant backlash going on, powerfully so in the southern states along the border. You see that in Japan, for example, where a society that is now the oldest on earth, and happily so, right? It's a sign of their prosperity and success as a society in public health that they're so old, but they're in desperate need of healthcare workers. But they would rather invent expensive robots to give company to their elderly then deal with the prospect of possible foreigners who might be happy to work at a fraction of the cost and with, you know, much greater human touch and attention. And so I think these are the kinds of things that do concern me very much. I'm living in China these days, so I do see some of what you're talking about, but I wouldn't say that China is any more tribal than America is at our on our worst day. I think that the more China gets connected with the world, and that's a process. Let's remember, the country went through dark ages under Mao, and it's only a fairly recent process that China has opened to the world. The entry to the WTO was only 10 years ago, to give one marker of its openness being recent. I think we'll see less of that, just as we will see some of the xenophobia that we see in America recede, I think, as the economy rebounds. I mean, if you take a long sweep of history, our country has been built on open ideas, open borders, open flow of goods and services. And I think that's, I hope we don't turn our back on our traditional strengths. So I think you're right to identify those trends. But I think if we can show the possibilities of a growing pie, we're much more likely to see people come along and embrace a more open approach. If when the pie is shrinking, I can assure you the battles will be fiercer. And so that's why I'm a big believer in embracing that change, because if we can show opportunity to more people, they're less likely to close the doors that historically have been open in America.
But protectionism is a really difficult thing to battle. I mean, it's very easy to see jobs flowing outward across the border and say, wow, that's maybe a job that I would like to have, or I don't have a job at the moment and any job is better than not having a job. And it's really easy to look at the benefits that we have from, say, something like the iPad being produced in China. Tremendous number of jobs created in China, a tremendous number of jobs, frankly, created in the United States, and very high-end jobs, design, engineering, things that require a complex understanding of human interaction, of engineering technologies, you know, very highly skilled knowledge worker types of jobs. But what about, getting back to the question of what about Kansas? You know, what about the people in the United States who, or any country for that matter, but speaking very selfishly, what about the people who don't have easy access to these high-end jobs and see the low-end jobs leaving the country? How do we guard against that kind of, that, you know, not necessarily xenophobia, but protectionism, looking at it as a zero-sum game?
Let me answer in two ways. I mean, partly you answered your own question by observing, as some people don't, that it's not just the sucking sound that takes away jobs to sweatshops in China, but we all, the lion's share of the value from the iPad, we know, comes to Americans. Mm-hmm. It comes not only to the creative designers and the marketers, but also to Apple shareholders. Well, who are shareholders? America is a shareholder society. It's pension funds, you know, it's mutual funds. This is broadly dispersed gains across America. And so that's not just a few elites somewhere sitting in Cupertino, you mm-hmm. know, sort of smoking cigars or something like that. And so that's part of the
that's
answer.
Not what they smoke in Cupertino.
Right, exactly. I mean, whatever they smoke, exactly. whatever it is, it's working. So, you know, keep more power to them. But the other point is that, you know, the benefits of innovation are not only on the supply side. America has been the greatest innovation success story of the last century because we are also a voracious consumer of innovation. And it has been written that, you know, we are a venturesome economy and venturesome consumers. That is, we devour new products, new ideas, new business models. And that, I think, is a powerful complement to the idea of just coming up with new technologies mm-hmm. and selling them to the world. We embrace them and use them. Mm-hmm. So think how much, for those of you that do use iPads and iPhones and everything, how much your life has improved, how much has your productivity improved, your networking, just your quality of life, right? I'm not to just give Apple kudos. Technology generally, when you embrace it, and lots of economic studies have shown throughout history that it's not the inventor of a new technology or even a country that comes up with a new technology, but the one that adapts, adopts, diffuses, and voraciously consumes invention that actually turns it into innovation. Mm-hmm. So I think America being open to those things actually makes us wealthier and more prosperous and more innovative in mm-hmm. the broadest sense of the word. The second way I would answer that question is some jobs are gone and they're not going to come back. Hmm. You know, this is not a day to get together and give false promise, right? I think we need to be sober. The bottom-end manufacturing jobs are not going to come back. But guess what? The story about China itself is we are at the end of cheap China. China itself is hitting middle age and middle income. And I wrote a lengthy story in The Economist based on a lot of frontline reporting that made the case that how and why the workshop to the world, that is the coastal provinces of China, which are really where a lot of the world's manufacturing is done, has seen double-digit increases in salaries, in benefits, in the burden of regulations. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, and this has been true for a number of years now, I mean, Foxconn, even before the big report issued by the NGO inspecting Apple's factories this week, had already raised salaries 25% last month. And it's going to increase them dramatically more, as will all the competitors that want to do business with multinationals, right? That's happening. But it's really happening because of pressure from middle-class Chinese. There are 300 million-plus Chinese who are in the middle class by global standards. And what are they demanding? They don't want toxic sludge dumped on their children by their own factory bosses. They were willing to tolerate this when they had no option other than, you know, miserable indigent lifestyles as indentured servants in the countryside. They put up with horrible jobs in sweatshops. They're not putting up with it anymore. There are protests all across China. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good thing, because what this means is China itself is moving up the value chain. That poses real challenges for China. And part of what I argued based on my reporting is Vietnam ain't going to be the next China. We're not going to see cheap China move to the next poor country. Not even interior coastal China is going to be the new China. The logistics are terrible in the interior of China, for those of you that have done business there. It costs more to ship from the interior to Shanghai than from Shanghai to New York, just to give you an idea. And the supply chains are very weak in Indonesia. The corruption problems in India are endemic. Vietnam worker productivity is abysmal compared to China. In other words, there are lots of reasons why China is going to continue to manufacture, but the world is stuck with more expensive China. And that means the stuff we buy at Walmart is going to cost a little more, but it does give a chance for U.S. manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to shut down a factory in China and bring it here, but the next factory that a multinational builds, they might think about, you know what, why don't I be close to the biggest market in the world, which is still America? Why don't I place my new factory in America where I can use 3D manufacturing, 3D printing, the advanced tools of CAD-CAM that are now becoming much less expensive. This revolution in high-tech manufacturing that's coming, that Germany, frankly, is doing quite well on, we can do here in America too. So that's the answer I give to Kansas, is the jobs that left won't come back, but just like the last buggy whip maker never saw that job come back, we will invent the car of the future and other industries of the future here.
Okay, at this point, I would like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. We're listening to Need, Speed, and Greed with Vijay Vithaswaran and Michael Meyer from Essential. At this point, I would like to ask a question. I was lucky enough to be at the Economist Ideas conference in Berkeley on Wednesday, and Michael was there too. And Vijay was leading this entire conference. One of the things that came out that I'm interested in, you and Michael both started out as engineers. Michael's a designer. Carl Bass, the CEO of Autodesk, at the conference on Wednesday, brought up the issue of design thinking and new an approach to innovation. He was asked that question from the audience, and he had a very negative response to it. I wonder if you guys could each answer about what is this design thinking thing? Is it just a buzzword? Is it Carl Bass put out the idea that it is a way to sell books and a way for consultancies like Essential and IDEO to get new business? So I'd like to ask both of you guys, what does that mean in terms of innovation?
Yeah. So... So yeah, I mean, design thinking, at the point that it becomes a buzzword, a registered service mark, something that has the little superscript letters after it, it is a tool that we use to label something that is, you know, a service that is different from what most people do. If you look at the way that design, and I'll open it a little bit more broadly, teams of designers and engineers work together to solve problems and create things, there actually is a difference in the way that these teams work together than most teams work together
in most business. If you walk into your average office building and you sit there and you watch the interactions that people have, you see an awful lot of solo work. This idea of I am crafting a plan, I am crafting a presentation, I am working through my tasks, and then I will share that with everyone else, which means I will make them sit in a darkened room and project PowerPoint slides until they either collapse, or they fall asleep. In contrast, design teams, the teams of designers and engineers, work in a highly collaborative fashion. They throw out ideas, they tear apart each other's ideas, they build upon each other's ideas. They also are not afraid to spend time watching and thinking and trying new ways of solving a problem, knowing that it's probably not going to work, but at least they'll learn something interesting from the failure. So design teams have a fundamentally different way of working together and also of thinking through the problems that they're trying to solve. So in that sense, I think that design thinking actually does exist, but it's more the practice of being a person on a design team than it is any sort of trademarked concept of design thinking.
I would say, just briefly, because you gave an intimately insider's answer, having been at IDEO and some of the other key places that advocate design thinking, I do think it's overblown, but I think it's silly to rubbish it as though there's nothing there. Mm. I think in part the movement towards design thinking comes from some of the intellectual bankruptcy of traditional management consultancies. Now, if you're going to be rude about somebody, be rude about management consultancies, right? because there you really do find a couple of problems. That is sort of the PowerPoint mentality as well as the analysis paralysis that comes from everybody studying the same Harvard Business School case studies. And you get sort of caught in a way where CEOs use the mm-hmm. consultants to cover their behind to do what they wanted to do anyway, right? So there was a problem in sort of getting smart, fresh thinking on difficult problems at the top of companies. And that created an opening for a new way of looking at it. And where I see some value in design thinking is that it encourages, for example, looking at problems in the round, integrated thinking, right? So you come at a problem and you do look at the anthropological element, that is, go talk to actual people, consumers, get to understand and try to understand how they see your product or how they see your government services. And don't just start with academic or economic analysis, right? The dry stuff. Get real. The other thing you do see is a willingness to move quickly with fast prototyping. That is, try things. It's okay to fail. And fast prototyping and experimentation is a big part of the design thinking process, and so is interdisciplinary collaborative approaches. That's not typical in the C-suite at most big companies. In bringing in people who are not on the front lines, for example, to help think about a problem. And so I think these iterative loops can help lead to faster knowledge turns. That is, try stuff. It doesn't work. It's okay. You have permission to fail. Learn the right lessons, and then come back and try something else. This is one of my lessons or rules, right? Fail gracefully. So as long as design thinking is a shorthand for some of these new ways of trying to solve problems that, frankly, are just common sense, but dare I say it, common sense is sometimes missing in corporate America, I'm okay with design thinking. Let's just not build it up as though it's the only tool in the toolkit.
Yeah. I actually think there's also an interesting idea. Remember the conversation you had with Clay Christensen the other day?
Sure, the great Harvard Business School expert.
He had this very interesting observation. Actually, it was his idea that when he does reach the pearly gates, he would ask St. Peter, why is it that you make us live in the future, but only let us get to see what happened in the past? And interestingly, I hadn't really thought about this before, but when I think about design thinking and the way that design teams work and think about problems, they really do live in the future, right? It's not about analyzing the past data and trying to extrapolate what the solution is, which is the typical approach that most businesses take. It's about looking at the current situation, looking at the past to see maybe how we got ourselves there, or if we can find some inspiration from the past, and then imagining what the solution would be in the future. And not making it bound to the current state, other than we have to be able to make a rational departure from what we're doing now to what we ought to be doing in the future. And I think that is one of the elements that does differentiate the way that design teams think from the way that most other teams think.
Shall we get another question or two?
Sir, gentleman in the beard.
up to the podium.
My question is about where we're spending our innovation. But I have to, just for a second, many, many years ago, got an engineering degree, and after that, a design degree. So I've been exposed to both. And really what I think design thinking is solving the problems when there isn't a formula to use to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. As an engineer, I was trained how to solve problems with that formula. Mm-hmm. As a designer, I was trained how to solve the problem when nobody could come up with the formula.
That's fair.
But back to my question. Most of our innovation seems to be addressing things. As a developed world, and as more and more of it develops, we all want things. We're designing more and more things, better things, things that are obsolete 8 months or a year after we've created them. We're going to run out of things, materials to make things, I fear. And how are we going to change our innovation so that it addresses what we really need to be doing? So that's my question.
Well, that's a profound question, I think. I guess I would say I'm with you on the first principle that's invoked by your question, because as I started my talk by pointing out, innovation is not about technology. What you rightly rail against is a view of innovation as about new products, new stuff. And I share that concern that you have. As long as we conflate what is something powerful and important and necessary, which is value-creating innovation, with just producing more gadgets and gizmos and stuff, I think we're headed down the wrong path. Those things can be part of the process. I'm not against new products that improve people's lives, but let's not make that the be-all and end-all of the process. Let's start with actually invoking again Clay Christensen, who's such a deep thinker on innovation. I recommend him to you all if you're not familiar with his work. I describe some of his key theories in the book. He said, don't think about the customer. Don't think about the product. Think about the job that needs to get done. And he gave the example that during Caesar's time, the job that needed to get done to get a message from here to there, he organized a legion of his troops to go and carry a letter from one end of the empire to the other. Today we have Federal Express, right? But the job is still the same. We have new techniques, new technologies, new means, but you can actually go back and step back from the obsessive focus on products and even going against all of marketing wisdom, against thinking of the customer as a unit, and actually think what jobs need to get done. And then you would actually move away from some of the material obsession of consumerism and say, what is it our real needs are? And I think that gets a little way towards it. He says it much more profoundly than I can, but I share some of your concerns.
I would add that I think that the design process naturally and essentially automatically adjusts itself to the materials that are available. Designers really rely on having this intimate understanding of the materials that they have available to craft a solution, and will find the most appropriate use of those materials to solve the problem at hand or to fulfill the job that exists to be done. And I've seen it over and over again. As the materials change, the things that get designed also change. The fundamental process doesn't change that much. If you look at, to be very pointed about it, if you look at right now, we used to think of ourselves as designing physical products or designing digital products. We were industrial designers or we were interaction designers. The concept of service design, where we're really sort of embodiment agnostic, is one that is very current within the design community. And it's all about understanding what is it that people want. Is that best delivered through a physical device, through some sort of digital interaction, or an interaction with a person who's providing a service, and then drawing on all of those materials to craft the right solution. So if we were to be left with no physical materials to design with, I think that we would still find interesting ways of solving that job to be done. Sir.
Um,
Thank you very much for actually coming and speaking here. My name is Sudeep. I'm actually an engineer and a designer. And I sort of, a few years ago, took on the audacious task of actually trying to design beautiful communities and actually founded a venture, designbeautifulcommunities.org. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that that our institutions, whether it's the financial systems or even the government systems, they're not really ready for innovation. You know, I just see that whether it is applying for a loan or whether it is politicians or leaders in the government who are relying so much on job creation, when in reality the problem is where the solutions are. And so this is bringing back to Kansas, I suppose, the American challenge. I'm just concerned about how, and I want to get your feel about, and how, whether you talk to people and shake them and say, why are we not changing the systems in America right now? Why are we going through such a long, protracted economic slump when there are people who've got the skills? Americans, we've never gotten any poorer in terms of our value. We've got the capacity to create. It's just that the building blocks of innovation haven't readjusted themselves to creating the prosperity because we've been focusing on the institutions that haven't morphed. So I just want to get a feel for it. Thank you.
Sure. No, thank you. You put it beautifully that we have all of the ingredients, but they need to recombine. If you look at the analogy of Japan versus the United States, back in the 80s, of course, everyone said Japan's rise will mean the decline of the U.S. I don't have to belabor the point with you. You all know what I think about this. Innovation is not a zero-sum game. Japan's rise, peaceful rise, came hand in hand with America moving from strength to strength and becoming a much, much wealthier society in the last 40 years. But what happened in Japan is instructive because once they hit the frontiers of technology in a number of industries, they were unable to adapt. When they hit their real estate bubble, as we have recently, they were unable to remobilize, recombine their physical assets and their human capital, in part because of their social contract. Right? This is a society that believes very much in stability. They would rather have a stagnant stability than a disruptive dynamism. And America has always had the opposite compact, that we believe that we, as long as we keep our markets open, our minds open, that we can grow, we can lead to a more prosperity, and that will require mobility. Part of the reason why we're trapped where we are now is how we regulated the financial sector, in part as well as individual responsibility, right? People were getting into mortgages that they couldn't afford, right? Based in part of mis-selling and abuse. And now our political process is unwinding this. Number of people who are underwater, and many of you know this, it's us, it's our friends, it's our families, it's our relatives across the country. Labor market mobility is greatly hindered in America. We could actually accelerate that process of renewal if we could find a simpler fix to the problem of housing, of the housing mess. And I say this because labor mobility is essential, as is the mobility of capital, as is the mobility of ideas and business models, right? And we're caught in a moment. I don't think it'll last very long, but it is slowing down the pace at which we would naturally recombine those wonderful elements of American dynamism. And I think that's part of why it feels like an un-American moment. Now, there's something unnatural holding us back at the moment that when we saw, when we did hit the slump with the original rise of Japan and the difficulties in manufacturing, we created new industries of the future, again, with software. With the dot-com bubble burst, we recombined those financial and personal and creative energies. That's why Silicon Valley has done much better than, for example, Route 128, the area outside of Boston. Back in the 1980s, Digital, Wang, there were a number of huge players in the computing space that were threatened by the rise of the personal computer, just like the companies here like Hewlett-Packard were. But what happened? They all poo-pooed it, right, at first. The guys in Silicon Valley made mistakes. They picked themselves up, went on, and managed to survive and flourish. IBM is another example company that was skeptical, but they created their own PC down in Boca Raton, away from the corporate culture in New York that would have killed it. And they gave a couple of guys a little bit of money and said, come up with a PC. They did. They said, this was good. They made an IBM version of it. What happened when they outgrew that model? They said, you know what, let's sell it to the Chinese. It's called Lenovo. They went on to a services model. And so they were able to reinvent themselves. Digital, Wang, those names are bankrupt. They don't exist anymore. And Route 128 was a very hierarchical way of doing corporations, where deference to authority, where dissent was not very much tolerated, where you didn't have the cross-fertilization among companies the way you do in Silicon Valley, where you didn't have permission to fail. So I think even within America, there's regional variety. Let's learn from the best of America.
Yeah, I think I would actually, I would take the view that I actually kind of disagree with this premise, that we're not applying innovation, we're not allowing businesses, organizations, the nation to restructure. I think that it's just perhaps our government is not being as effective at prompting or guiding that as it ought to be. But at a small business level and at an individual level, I think that it's actually happening quite a bit. And I have actually some statistics to offer in defense of that or in support of that, but also a lot of anecdotal evidence. One of the things that I've seen over the last couple of recessions and recoveries is that the product development sector tends to be a leading indicator of the economy. We get sick before everyone else does, and we start to get better before everyone else does. And right now, I cannot hire designers. If you are an iOS developer, I would like to talk to you after this meeting. We can't find enough good people. There is a tremendous focus on new product development, on innovation happening right now, and everybody in my industry feels that. And a lot of individuals are out there learning the skills to be part of that. So there's a lot of individual movement happening there. If you look at the labor productivity figures over the last 5 years, it's actually risen dramatically. Small businesses, even manufacturing enterprises, are becoming much more efficient at getting the job done with constrained resources. We can't afford to hire people, or we have to lay people off. Okay, we'll figure out how to make these widgets with fewer people. If that means investing in individuals, small companies are doing that. If that means investing in capital equipment even, small companies are doing that, but they're doing it in a very smart manner. They're being very, very frugal, kind of getting to the frugal innovation idea that we don't have time to talk about today. But I think that what is going to happen, and the reason that you're asking the question, why aren't we applying this innovation, why aren't we restructuring ourselves to work smarter, better, faster, I think that the answer is we are. It's simply that it takes a little bit of lag. There's a little bit of lag time before we actually see that happening. The product development cycle, it is fast. It is faster than it has ever been, but it is still a finite cycle. It takes a certain amount of time to design a thing, getting it into manufacturing and out on shelves. In the next year, we're going to be seeing a lot of really, really cool products coming out onto the market, a lot of really, really cool services, a lot of really, really interesting innovations hitting the marketplace. We're also going to see the effects of businesses getting smarter about doing the business that they always have been doing. And I think probably 2 or 3 years from now, we're going to start seeing the Harvard Business Review articles that say, wow, remember that horrible recession we had? Here are how these market-leading companies got themselves through it and made the most of it. And if we do these things next time, or maybe if we restructure ourselves to do these things now, the rest of us can benefit from that. So for us as individuals, I think that the key thing that we can do if we're not part of this innovation right now is 2 or 3 years from now, when these lessons start bubbling to the surface, pressure our governments to learn from that, pressure our big businesses to learn from that, so that we can be ready for the next time that this happens.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program today where we only have time for one short question, and that will be my question. I would like to thank both of our panelists today. Our program today was Need, Speed, and Greed with Vijay Vaitheeswaran in conversation with Michael Meyer of Essential. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. We were your hosts today for this program. So we're almost out of time now, and Vijay has to get on to his next engagement. But if you could, each of you could just give a closing statement, kind of Twitter style, of innovation, of understanding, and of hope for our audience here at the Commonwealth Club today and our audience listening at home. Michael, we'll start with you, and I'd like to end with Vijay.
So, Twitter style.
Or Facebook style.
I'll go Twitter style.
Pinterest style.
Old Pinterest or new Pinterest? No, so Twitter style. What I think, understand what people want, make cool shit.
Wow. Okay, Vijay.
move nimbly, open wisely, fail gracefully. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club today, and thank you to everyone, our panelists. And with that, I would like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion.